The title of our session this morning is What You Believe is What You Get. Rather cynical sounding statement, and I think we'll find a place where that plugs in. I'm hoping also that before the week is out, we'll find where that doesn't apply. Dan Erlander has drawn us a picture to help make everything clear for us. It's a picture of the world. And so if we get into topics that are just a little confusing, just focus your attention on this and all will be made clear. We're going to be talking about culture, what culture is, how culture operates, what the dynamics of culture are. And we'll see places where our faith relates to that. And then we're also going to look at the Christian mission of the church. And see where that connects in with this whole issue of culture and cultural change. I'd like to begin with a proverb that shows a rather interesting approach to a culture. Sometimes it's very hard for us to be introspective and understand ourselves, either as individuals or as a group. And so it helps to look outside of ourselves and find someone or something else. Proverbs 6, verses 6 to 8. Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief officer or ruler, she prepares her food in summer and gathers her sustenance in harvest. So we're going to go to the ant to try to figure out culture. First of all, we find ourselves an ant hill and we look at it and we notice its shape and we notice it's made up of grains of sand and we examine them very carefully and analyze the size of those grains of sand and measure it, map it out. And we will scrape away the sand and find the openings down underground. And we'll examine those and map out the whole huge house that the ants live in. We will explore further and find that the passages are of different sizes and different shapes. We'll measure how far they go down into the ground, and not only will we find their housing, their analyze their habitat, but we may discover some other artifacts, such as droppings, and perhaps we will analyze carefully the refuse, the waste that's been removed and thrown into the garbage pit, which forms the roof of their house, and we will perhaps find some of their tools, the chisels and the hammers and the bulldozers that they use to carve out their house. And we will look at their dishwashers and their home appliances and their TV sets and their little computers. We will, in essence, get a grasp of the entire technology of this society. So as we look at ant culture, the first thing that we will be analyzing is the technological or material level of their culture. But of course, no sociologist would be content with that. So a sociologist would be interested in the ants themselves and what they do and how they live. So we look down and we peer at another ant hill and we find that this one is indeed inhabited, and there are ants scurrying about to and fro, running in and out of the openings. If we look carefully enough, we'll discover that as the ants run up and down the paths, they touch antlers. Not antlers, what do you call those? Feelers. They shake hands as they pass, and there seems to be a whole communications network going on. We also will find that some of the ants are very busy. They're running out of the dwelling, carrying the refuse and the garbage and the stones and the rocks and doing excavating. And other ants are running back in, carrying bits of leaves and dead insects and food and building materials and so on and so forth. We'll find, however, that there are another group of ants that are rather lazy. They're sitting around not doing much. They even look a little different, too. They must be another race or something. But anyway, they have these great big pincers in front of them. They don't do very much. Until a different variety of ant comes on the scene, and then whoop, they are all mobilized to action, and so we discover soldier ants. We'll discover another group of ants that are all grouped around this big thing, and we aren't sure quite what it is, but they're all grouped around this other object, and we look a little more closely, and that appears to be one great big ant. And these ants seem to be spending their entire lives just grooming this one other ant, and feeding it, and so on and so forth. And so we've discovered, and if we watch carefully enough, and over a long enough period of time, we find that this community continues to operate like this until this one great big ant goes someplace else. And then everybody else follows, and they set up a new ant hill. And what we've discovered now is that there is a social structure to this culture. Indeed, there's also lines of authorities, because it isn't just any ant that can pull the whole hill to another location. It's this one ant, which we'll call a queen. So there's a political structure. And we find that in the touching of antlers, or whatever they are, that there's a communications network. And together with the communications network, there's an economy. There's a method of exchanging of goods and services, of harvesting the land, and of providing these foods and other services to other people. So there's a whole level of ant culture, which is the social, political, and economic level of culture. So much for sociologists. Now, are any of you cultural anthropologists? Or had some background? I met somebody here in the village who is. Well, an anthropologist is going to go another step further. He's going to want to know why. Why do ants do these things? What does it all mean to them? So the anthropologist must go another step, and he does his ant in the path interview. Scoops up the ant and says, "Hello, ant, will you care to answer a few questions for me about what all of this activity means? And perhaps fill out a questionnaire so we can do a research project." He will find that this particular ant is a worker ant. And he's scurrying about all his life just doing enormous tasks while the soldiers are relaxing and the other ants are basking in the company of the queen. And he'll ask this ant, "Don't you feel it's just a little bit unfair that you and a few others are doing all the work of this society while there are others who are just kind of basking in the fruits of your labors?" The ant will say, "Oh no, not really. We're all brothers and sisters, you see. We all have the same parent, same mother. And so we're all one big family." "Yes, but still, even in a family, there can be sibling rivalry. Don't you feel that your sisters and brothers over here, the soldiers, that they're just kind of getting the benefits and you're getting the short end of the stick?" And the ant would probably say, "Well, no, you see, we were all taught by our Aunt Luther that there are orders to creation, and it is not our place to upset the orders of creation. So we accept this the way it is." We might try to probe a little deeper into the whys of life. "Well, what does all of your life here together mean? Have you always lived here? Has this always been your home?" The ant would tell us, "No, there was a time when we lived in another land, and we were an enslaved people, held in terror by the great ant eater. However, after years of this terror and humiliation under the ant eater, our great ant in the sky called one of us, and our brother Moses led us all in a great progression to the edge of the sea, whereupon we embarked on a bit of flotsam and drifted for 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness of the sea, until we came finally to rest at this place, which is our promised land." The ant would go on, if we asked more and more stories to try to understand the whys of their environment, we might get him talking about other ants besides those in his hill. And he would tell us in great deal of fear and terror about another ant hill down the path. Those are the red ants. Now, the red ants want to take over the world. They've already devoured and conquered several other hills, and they would devour us too. What are you doing about that? We're prepared. You see, all of us work together to bring more and more food to the queen, so that the queen can produce more and more soldiers. And we have these soldiers now staked out all around the hill to protect us and to terrify the red ants so that they wouldn't dare to attack us. Well, we're going on, and we could continue on and on, but what we're trying to demonstrate is that the behavior of the community, this whole social, political, and economic order, together with the material culture and the technology that's involved, is really coming out of and related to another level called meaning. The meanings of life wrapped up in the stories we tell ourselves, in the symbols we use, the symbol of family, brother and sister, stories of creation, stories of our origins, hopes and fears for the future. Whole level of meanings in culture tell us who we are, where we are going, how we are related to all the other peoples, animals, whatever, of the world. I'll give you an idea how significant this meaning level is, completely apart from what happens at the material, technical level and social, political, economic. Let's consider the fact that for over 1,000 years, the Chinese people had the technology to produce rockets. In fact, they have produced rockets for over 1,000 years. They had developed chemicals which would react and burn fast enough or explosively enough to produce rockets, and they used these for fireworks displays and great festive occasions and for celebrations. The Chinese rockets were quite complex in their technology and in more advanced years. But they had one application, and that was as fireworks. Now, the Chinese were also very much involved in war with their neighbors for over those same 1,000 years. But it was not appropriate, and never considered appropriate, the meaning level of their culture to apply the technology of rocketry to the art of war. It was at this level that, consciously or not consciously, the decision was made as to what of the material culture, what of the technology that was in their midst would be used for what applications. And it's only been in the last several years that the general concept that any technology is appropriate in war, that there are not rules of war as such, but that whatever will work will do, a pragmatic approach, has opened up the possibilities of germ warfare, chemical warfare, and the use of rocketry. That's not to cast a value judgment on that, but merely to show how strongly the meanings by which we live affect the rest of our culture. Now, this web of meanings is a peculiar sort of thing in that it is very comprehensive and that it explains most of our life. It provides opportunities for us to do things. It opens up possibilities for us. But it is also somewhat interchangeable. When I was in college, I spent my junior year in Beirut, Lebanon. And lived in the dormitory, and a few doors down was a Lebanese fellow named Daoud, whom I first met at a party, and he was the biggest cut up and the most lively party person I had ever seen in my life. He was not the MC, but he would be interrupting the MC to tell a rowdy joke. He was dancing and he was singing, and he was just the most, he was the life of the party. And a few days later, I hadn't seen Daoud for a little while, and I asked some other people in the dorm about him, and they said, well, he's locked himself in his room. And he would stay locked in his room for days at a time. And other times we would see him, and he would be his jovial, lively self. And I was also taking Psychology 101. So I said, aha, manic depressive. I was rather proud of myself. Sometime later in the semester, I was talking with the professor of the psychology course, and he said, by the way, do you happen to know Daoud? I said, yes, he's a friend of mine. He lives down the hall. Well, let me talk with you about him a bit. So we talked, and he said, well, you know, Daud is possessed by a demon. I said, oh, well. And he went on to explain that this demon throws him into the depressions and holds him down. Also, at other times, the demon causes his so-called manic states and gets him excited. The professor had been counseling with Daud over an extended period of time now. And he explained that what they had done was, first he had helped Daud to understand that there was indeed a very serious problem here. And Daud explained, yes, I know, this demon has been bothering me. And they talked at some length about what the demon was doing and how the demon was behaving and how this was threatening Daud's life. And finally they were able to, by putting Daud in a trance, bring the demon forth, speak with the demon. And I don't know the details, but over the long haul, they had made the demon feel very uncomfortable with Daud. They had forced the demon into agreeing that he would not cause death or serious bodily injury, because that would threaten his home. And over an extended period of time, the demon had decided that this was not a healthy place to live, and left. Curious thing was, this is my psych professor who had taught me what manic depressive states were all about, who is now talking about demonology. And it shows that two entirely different systems of meaning were accounting for the events, or could account for the events. There would certainly be no way of convincing Daud that he had a psychological disorder. Neither was there any real way that the professor would be able to convince me that the difficulties that I had in my life were caused by demons. We came from different worlds, experienced much of the same phenomena, and yet our meaning frameworks, which made sense of those phenomena, were entirely different. Another aspect of this meaning thing is how comprehensive and how all explaining a meaning system can be. All you need to do is think of the Jones group. What was his name?
Jim Jones,
right. And how, given a very bizarre kind of theology and understanding of the world, it was sufficient to account for all experience for them. It was sufficient to account for why they must be a separate group and a different group and must live entirely differently from the rest of the world. It provided explanations that they were being harassed and oppressed and discriminated against by another society, so that they had to form their own community. And it even led to voluntary annihilation. And there are many ways of framing the world, but this is a characteristic that it can be all-embracing. To use another example, among some of our Christian groups, several years ago I heard Charles and Francis Hunter. Are any of you familiar with them? Those names ring a bell. Well, Charles Hunter was speaking at an evangelistic meeting. And he was explaining how he was a salesman, and he relied very much upon God in his life. And he felt very strongly that God had a concern not just with abstract feelings, but with the very specific events that happen to each of us in our daily life. And so he prayed to God constantly through the day, asking God's help and God's guidance for each little decision that he needed to make. And he was explaining how, as a salesman, he was on his way to a very important meeting in which he had hoped to close a deal. He was late. It was rush hour. He was driving down the freeway and prayed to God for guidance, and God would help him decide when to pass and which lane to get in, so that he would be able to make it to his meeting on time and be able to close the deal to the glory of God. And he said he made it faster than he had ever made it before down the freeway at rush hour. Another time he is in a clothing store buying a suit, and he prays to God that God will guide his selection as he looks at the materials and choose a suit that will make him look pleasing and attractive so that he might be more successful in his business, all to the glory of God. Here is a system of thought which provides meaning, and meaning at what we consider a fairly high level, that is a meaning wrapped up in the faith and wrapped up in images that we, the images of creation and redemption and so on, applying to each point in daily life. Listening further to him and to others who share this type of approach, one can see that in one's own personal life, everything that happens that is a joy, everything that brings happiness, is a gift of God and is a blessing. It is also a reward for righteousness and for following the Lord. Everything that happens in my life that is discomforting, that is frustrating, that is grieving, that is anxious, is a temptation of the Lord and a testing of my faith. Now, that's true for all believers, but for non-believers, what happens to them that is good and a blessing is but a temporary thing. It is but a minor interlude until they receive their comeuppance. Well, everything that happens that is evil and everything that happens that is painful and upsetting to them is a chiding, a chastisement, or a punishment of the Lord, trying to draw them to him. And so everything that happens in the entire universe has a meaning. And this meaning, and there's no way then that this system can be broken into. It's a complete, comprehensive, and closed system for understanding the world. And some of us who come from very different traditions would have absolutely no way to argue this thing down. So that's another aspect of the meaning level of a culture, that it can be at times so comprehensive and so complete that it excludes other possible understandings and meanings. And we've already seen now how we are moving into, in talking about culture, cultural meanings, we're moving into areas that we think of in terms of our faith. Indeed, the faith is directly related to this most powerful aspect of our culture. And if we take that seriously, then we must understand that our faith is the most powerful and the most threatening thing that our culture, the thing that we have to bring to bear upon our culture. Here, I guess we should back up just a little bit as we talk about faith, because faith can be thought of in many different levels, a belief system, or whatever. I like to think of faith as something somewhat akin to marriage. Well, marriage is fundamentally and first of all and primarily a relationship. But we could describe that relationship if we wanted to. What are some descriptors of marriage? What kind of words come to your mind? What describes marriage? What is it? Commitment.
Love.
Love.
Sharing.
Sharing.
Companionship.
What was that?
Companionship.
Companionship.
Partnership.
Partnership.
Walk on a tightrope.
Walking on a tightrope. Understanding. Caring.
Fight without threat.
Fight without threat. All right. All that we've said right now, we would agree, isn't marriage itself. It's a description of. There are symbols that represent the thing itself. Likewise, when our faith, and as we talk about our faith, this is the sense we must keep in our mind, that we're really, the faith itself is the relationship, is the involvement with God and with Christ. That's the faith. But we will talk about that faith, and we'll see that that faith has certain descriptors attached to it, and some of those descriptors are beliefs and affirmations that we make and creedal statements and other things that we can say about faith. And yet we're really one level down. We're talking about something without it being the thing itself. When I remember hearing a fellow who was straight out of Yale Divinity School present a chapel service at our school. Chapel services were voluntary, and so the only people who came were the religion majors and those who were particularly interested in that sort of thing. And we came if there was nothing better to do, and we thought there might be some lofty theological discussion that we could enlighten ourselves with. We anticipated this fresh Yale graduate giving us the latest word on contemporary theology. And what he did instead was he told us a story. He said a long time ago, in a faraway land, there was a place where there was a lot of oppression and hunger and disease, and there were slaves, and there was a great deal of injustice, and so on and so forth. There lived a person who, instead of, like everybody else, deciding that he was going to try to manipulate the system to get what he needed for his own sustenance and to pursue his career, a person who happened to be well-trained in one of the professions and could have done quite well for himself following the rules of the system, instead became very much concerned for the unfortunate and the poor, sick, and so on. And he lived a life in which he spent time making friends with people he was not supposed to associate with. He made friends with the oppressed and with the oppressors as well. And he went on and on and talked about how this angered many people whose lives and whose livelihood and who felt that whole of society depended upon rigid structures dividing people and establishing their roles. It angered them to see him doing this and associating with despicable people and sinners and lawbreakers and oppressors as well. They chided him for this and he didn't change his ways. They arrested him and he didn't change his ways and they killed him. End of the service. Very simple story. And that story is a story that I'll never forget, and I don't think any of us there will forget that story, the way it was told. It became a paradigm. It became one of the symbols in this whole battery of meanings, which helped to form our understanding of what the world was like, and who we were invited to become, who we were invited to follow, what we were invited to do, and what the consequences of doing that and following that way would be. Now, in contrast to what I described before with the story of life, if you will, that the hunters have and other people have told about, how we can understand every good thing that happens to us, every bad thing that happens to us, and so on. This story is a very different story. This is a very open-ended story. The end hasn't yet been written. It's an entirely different story meant to relate to exactly the same world, as radically different from the previous story as an understanding of manic depressive is from an understanding of demons. Different stories that tell the same thing. Oh, it's about time, I guess, that we look at our drawing more carefully. Has that clarified anything for you? I realize now that maybe the reason it's not clear is that it's really upside down. Now I'm sure everything will really become very clear. Dan assured me this is our world, the world we live in. Would anyone like to help us understand what meanings are there? Let me give you a little help. We live in a very dangerous time. There are nations that are threatening to blow themselves off and everybody else off the face of the earth. We know the firepower of these nations far exceeds many times over what is needed to eliminate the entire race. We also live at a dangerous time in our homes where the crime rate is going up very rapidly. It's no longer safe to go out on the streets at night. We must be careful for ourselves, and we must teach our children to be cautious, keep the doors locked. Some of us are in such severe, or in areas where crime is so severe that we must even pack a gun to defend ourselves. We live in extremely threatening times. And so, because of that, we must follow a life of caution. We must be willing to pay the price for security and for safety. We must buy that alarm system for our house. We must invest in learning the martial arts, some of us. We must pay the price economically for our police and for our government to protect us and to defend us, which is their rightful duty within the orders of creation. Here's a meaning structure that helps to make sense out of a confusing world. It puts things in a framework so that now we can understand who we are, we now understand who our friends are, we now understand who our enemies are. And once we know that, we have not only an understanding of the world, but we have a program of action. We now know where to go as a people. The interesting thing is, when we talk about interchangeability of meaning systems, that this isn't the only way that the confusion of our world can be turned into sense. This is perhaps a way that makes sense to a lot of us and to a lot of people. But there's another way that we could say that the world has been made sense for us. And that's with a story. A story about long ago. A story that's also today. A story that says, yes, indeed, there's a great deal of suffering and pain and anxiety in the world. Whoopsie. This is a harder one to see, I think, for all of us. And it's very hard to find this in the world today. But anyway, let's look for it. I made a boo-boo on that line. And yet within this world, something very special and dramatic has happened. Something which is a foretaste of the future. A foretaste that we have now and can live by. That there is a great deal of beauty, there's a great deal of love, and a great deal of giving and caring. And despite all of the pain and suffering, despite the oppression, despite the word from the rest of the world that this is foolishness, we can live according to this vision of peace and love. We can dare to risk, we can dare to suffer, we can dare to be called fools for Christ. Can you see that second image? Is that appearing at all? Is there anything wrong with it?
It's not closed.
Not closed. That's a good point. It's not finished yet, is it? That it explains what we have and what we experience now, but it does something else. It invites us. More powerfully than the first image, this image invites us to participate in finishing it and concluding it. Here's the future. This is the foretaste of what is to come. We know what it is. We know where it's going. We know what the kingdom is going to be and will be like. So part of our meaning framework then is not just an explanation of what life is like, but it is an understanding of where life is going and where we participate in that going and that fulfillment and that completeness. Strongest thing I think that we need to understand is that no one image here is more realistic than the other. Each of them makes sense. We have a choice, however, as to which one or some other image we will adopt. And our choice is going to have an enormous effect, an enormous bearing on our personal lives, and it'll also have an enormous bearing on our community life, and is eventually on our on the life of our society. How are we doing on time? Do you have any questions at this point, or anything that you would like to share as we think about the about culture and faith? Yes.
I'm very dense. I have very, very little imagination. I haven't followed those
lines.
It's red lines or the blue ones. I don't have the slightest idea what to do.
Don't feel bad. I have trouble with it too. As you can see, I've worked with this. Can someone who sees some images here share them?
It's flying downward. That one. Tails up.
It's a bird.
A bird. Yeah. A dove of peace, the blue line.
Mm-hmm.
What's the red line?
Bomb.
Bomb. Rocket.
Yeah.
Put an eye on the head.
Put an eye on the head.
I think it would help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Easy. That's better.
Does that help? Okay. We'll thank Dan Erlander for this very clear understanding of the world. Let's try something. Before I take that down, was there anybody else who had something they wanted to share on this issue before we shift gears a little bit?
What are the lines that you didn't call? What do they mean? Just confusion?
Well,
come back tomorrow.
I invite you to complete the picture. That's we could carry on the analogy pretty far, probably, in terms of how within our initial learnings of faith, we find certain limited applications. And most of us have grown up in traditions in which the primary and first applications of the faith had to do with personal salvation and our personal relationship with God. And then many of us in more recent times have grown to see that really the faith also talks very much about a corporate community and the life of the church and what is involved in our relationships with each other and being part of the family of God. And maybe some of us have grown to the point where we're seeing that our faith speaks to our relationship not only within the community, within the church, but within many churches and even within the world. And some of us will be wrestling then with issues of how do we as followers of the way, those who embrace this particular vision, how do we then understand those who are outside the way? How do we relate to persons of other faiths? And in our culture, the person of the other faith usually isn't, say, an adherent of Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam or something like that, but is an adherent of what we might call agnosticism or some other approach to life rather than one that is following Christ. And I think that as we grow, we find that the symbols of our faith and the meaning levels become larger and larger and larger. And hopefully we continue to grow until we see that it is embracing, that within our faith there is an embracing and an understanding of the role of everything in the universe. That's you gave me a good platform for a sermon there. Thank you.
Okay, let's look at something. I can't spell.
How do you spell Christian mission?
Start with Christian. Okay, let's do some brainstorming here. What kind of words or ideas come to your mind when you hear the phrase Christian mission?
Brainwash.
Oh, that's a good one.
Let's see, I'm not sure where to put that. I'll put it right here.
Okay.
Go ye forth and make disciples.
Okay.
Of all nations.
I'm just going to put make disciples in here.
Brainwash, make disciples. What else?
Serve.
Serve.
Accept. Heal.
Heal.
Commitment. Teach.
Oh, wait, but we'll see here. Commitment. Yes. Commitment, and then there was
teach.
What else? Christian mission.
Hospitals. Schools.
Hospitals. Schools.
Feeding.
Gospel. Brotherhood. Westernize.
You hit the jackpot. You're the first one to get into the fourth column here.
We must be assisted here.
What's happening?
Example.
All right.
Mold. Yeah, to form them into shape.
Okay. Ask you to give me an example or just to elaborate on that just a little bit. Mold.
Well,
who's molding whom?
Well,
or what?
Well, it's sort of on the line of westernization, I guess.
Shape.
Shaping.
Molding. Dialogue.
All right.
I'm not comfortable with that.
Do you want dialogue in the fifth column?
Yeah.
We'll put it over here. Now you'll have to justify why it's there when you find out what this means. Okay. What other things? How many of you have read James Michener's Hawaii? A lot of you. Okay, does that prompt any other thoughts?
Rigidity.
I think I'm thinking of example over there, forcing them into our mold example.
Righteousness, that the missionary goes in with a feeling, you know, that I've got it all right and I'm going to make you fit into that.
Judgment.
We'll put it both ways.
Lovelessness.
Judgment.
You put that where you want.
Judgment. And someone else said something.
I said lovelessness.
That's what Christian mission suggests to you, lovelessness. Sort of kind of...
No, I got off on Hawaii.
Okay.
Love.
That one kind of hit the jackpot, didn't it?
Sacrifice.
What was that?
Sacrifice? The missionary sacrifices personal comforts and so forth.
Sharing.
Okay, I think we've gone far enough. Now, what we're doing here is somewhat artificial, because what you intended and what you're coming forth with may not fit into this system. But let's just look at some aspects of what you've been saying. These are things that the concept of Christian mission prompts in your mind. One of the first things that we think of in terms of mission activity is missionaries going out and preaching the word, saying something, telling a story. Now let's think of that in cultural context. People telling a story. This is how the world is. We have a confusing world. We may have a confusing world. Oh, somebody can't see this. I'll bring this face for it. Okay. We have a confusing world in which... Can you see it now? In which there may already be some explanations for how it works. Some of you may have read Peace Child. Have any of you run across that book? It was a Reader's Digest book. Anyway, it's a story of a New Guinea, rather savage New Guinea group that just recently has encountered those strange, weird people called missionaries. They have their own formulation of what the world is like. And the missionary is, in some respects, approaching that confusing world that already has an explanation and trying to draw a different picture. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you, that sort of thing. Brainwashing, perhaps, if you will, or it may be preaching the gospel. It is, in some way, telling a new story of life. It is presenting an image, a model of the new meanings of the culture. Now, the missionary is not just content to be telling stories. What comes out of that? What happens when people look at that and say, aha, that's a pretty good way to explain life? Or that story makes sense to me. Or I experience that in the center of my being. Yes. Well, then, a community is formed. Community is formed of those who share that same meaning and who tell that story to each other and who decide to live by that story and to follow out the consequences in the future of that story to make that gospel whole and complete in their lives. Now, the consequence of that, of course, is that if that gospel is to be made whole and complete in their lives, then it is to be made whole and complete in the world. It is not just enough to live according to a story of the gospel. We are to become the gospel. And so we don't just say that the blind shall see and the lame shall walk and those in prison shall be visited. We become that. We become grace to others. We become healing to the sick. We become education to those who are not informed. We become food to the hungry. We become love to those who are in need of it. So the whole service dimension, and service is a word that is unfortunately has some negative connotations as well, but this whole aspect of Christian mission is then the becoming of the story. It's the incarnation of this gospel in the world. So what's this last column? Mostly, it's unintended consequences. It's things that missionaries and those who send them would say, well, we really didn't intend to do that. That wasn't really our purpose. But it is the reason that such things happen is because of the enormous power of the faith and the enormous power of what we're talking about in terms of the transformation of a culture. When a
missionary who is a Westerner, who is an American, who is an Anglo, goes into another country that has a different race of people with different ideologies. It isn't merely his biblical teaching that is communicated. It is a whole lot of other things. When I first arrived in Indonesia, I've been there for a while, and someone who had just met another missionary who was from Texas, I was coming back from furlough, I just met him, and he came up to me and he asked me, "Do you think he packs a gun?" As a man intending to come and bring the gospel, but he was from Texas, so perhaps he packs a gun. There are many things that we carry at the meaning level of our culture that are communicated very strongly, which we may or may not intend. And so that produces a rather peculiar mix despite the intentions of those who are involved in mission. What we tried to do here is to see how closely related our analysis of culture is with what our faith is and what strong implications that has for the mission of the church. And we'll look at the exact dynamics of it. Yes?
We destroy their culture when we come in with our missions. We change it completely. Their culture is gone and they have to adopt ours. With all the good and bad, such are diseases that we never contacted them. A friend of mine was a mission down in Chile. And he said that when they contact these Indians up in the mountains, that over half of them died because they said, "We didn't know we had it, but diphtheria and other diseases we carried, they died." And he said that right away they started to put other missionaries in to adopt all the evils that we had. This wasn't what we intended, a real nice Christian man, but as he made contact with civilization, he destroyed really these Indian culture, which was a real good, strong culture. He said when they came in there, he said that any man who slept with any woman who wasn't his wife, they simply would throw rocks at him and drag him off, which meant death in the jungles. And he said that our culture isn't nearly that strict, but that man could never come back, and meant he died because he couldn't survive there. So he told the good and the bad of it, and there's a lot of bad. But their culture was destroyed by his contacting the Indians, which changed completely. The first man that ever contacted these wild tribes, and he survived, but he destroyed their culture. And over half of them died because of his contact with white men, which he'd never had before.
Now this raises some very, very difficult questions for us.
That's Reverend Pinchel. I don't know if you ever read
his
book on it. It's real good. Mm.
And it is partly because of such experiences and such stories and such, I don't mean story in the sense that it's not true, but story in the sense that it is true, that many in our churches are very hesitant and skeptical about the mission of the church, the Christian mission of the church, and feel that that is one of the more dubious areas of our endeavor. And so we've got a lot of wrestling to do with how do we, in some ways, how do we preach and become gospel in the world and understand our faith in a global sense.
I asked him how he could justify going in there and having over half died. He said, "Well, because when we have preparation so that they will come to our hospital, otherwise that if any minors or poor went through that area, then they would contact a known and take care of them." Because of us, some of them survived because we take them to the hospital and give medicine and that. But he said, "But without that, people just go through there and they contact the white man. They would acquire our disease, which we don't even know we have any people who have never been contacted." So we justified it that way, that their civilization was saved because we did give medicine, we did take care of those. Mm-hmm. But he admitted all the evils they brought together with the good, of course, spreading God's name. He was a Presbyterian.
One of the responses to that, and it's a response I feel has some merit, is to think not in terms of exporting an ideology. In other words, we didn't take the dove to the mission field. We discovered the dove on the mission field. And a great deal that can be
extend, that thought can be extended to a great extent, and that what we are doing is not exporting an ideology, not exporting those descriptors of our faith, such as the creeds, any more than we would export the descriptors of a marriage relationship. But we are discovering within a wide variety of the context, and that applies to this country as well as anywhere else. Our effort is then to discover where the Spirit is working right now, what it is doing, and what is the meaning of the cross in this context. But we'll be getting into that more some later as we look at the funny relationship between symbols and their meanings and how they interact. How long do we go? I guess we've gone long enough, haven't we? We go about an hour?
I think about an hour.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say anything more then. We'll start off next the next time talking about the relationships between symbols and meanings. And we'll look at the Batak experience, which has a lot of these ambiguous things happening in it. And we'll explore that a little further. We'll also look at several different biblical approaches to this question. And there's a wide, wide variety of responses throughout the history of the biblical people to how to wrestle with these powerful cultural meanings and their symbols and where our faith really stands with respect to them. Do you have anything else that you'd like to contribute at this point? We'll spend just a few minutes more in discussion.
Well, I can think of one example of what you were saying there, and that is the movement for equality between sexes is very strong, very important in this culture. But if you were to transport that to a Muslim mission, say in the Sub-Saharan region, you would be exporting an ideology. Is that what you're saying? You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't.
Well, that would be a question to raise. I guess the way you might approach that is to say, what would the gospel mean in that Sub-Saharan Muslim community? Would it be gospel for there to be a women's rights movement? Would it not be gospel? You would seek to find then what is the activity of the Spirit. Any of you have trouble with that term, looking for the activity of the Spirit in history? It's such a powerful and pregnant image. And yet some of us have associated it with a very specifically evangelical ideology that may or may not be broad enough to mean what we're trying to say. But I think that what it would be is not so much you'd say, well, we've had this egalitarian movement in the West, and we've had this egalitarian movement in the West, and we've had this one in the West, and we've freed our slaves, and we've protected our workers, we've allowed for conscientious objection, and we have to consider the role of women in society, and so on and so forth. Now let's compare this report card against the Sub-Saharan Muslim community. Oh, well, they haven't had a women's rights revolution yet, they still need to do something in terms of egalitarian among workers. I don't think that would be a healthy approach. It certainly wouldn't be a Christian approach.
The other thing that I wonder about is, I guess I'm kind of cursed with that. Maybe blessed sometime with a real a need for a goal definition, and I set an objective or a purpose and then arrange things to meet the purpose. And as I said, sometimes that's a real curse to me and sometimes it's a blessing. And approaching another culture that I can say initially I want to get acquainted with and come to know and so forth. There's a purpose in addition to that that I bring to this culture. That is telling about Jesus. And which you're saying, and kind of like that. By understanding where the spirit is active, it starts with the spirit is active everywhere, and then our job as missionaries or messengers, anyway, is to discover what the spirit is doing in that area, and I don't know then what. Like saying, well, help him, or a goal-oriented or a purpose-directed sort of person would say, well, try to help him, or clear away the blocks of the spirit.
Maybe the goal-oriented person would learn not to be goal-oriented.
And the follower of the way.
Can you see examples of what you mean by the word of spirit?
In the sense of discovering it somewhere. Well, I'll use the Batak people as an example. I attended an Easter sunrise service. Well, that's not a very good example. The Bataks traditionally have a concept called Sahala, which is the spiritual power of an individual. And you have Sahala not only by virtue of your talents and your abilities, but also by virtue of your relationship to other people. So a parent has Sahala over a child, and a teacher has Sahala over a student. We seek to be in the presence of those who have Sahala over us. We benefit from their spiritual power. In fact, to be spat upon by a great orator is a gift of his spiritual power in the spittle. I experienced this dramatically myself when I would go into the villages and there would be a handshaking. And we would all be, this was very important. It wasn't the Western concept of shaking hands, hello, how do you do? But shake hands, and first would be with all the elders and all the male elders in the church, and then all the married women in the church, and then all the youth in the church. And the thing that struck me was it was a serious and solemn occasion. There was very little spoken except perhaps the one word horas, which is equivalent to shalom. And gradually I began to see that what was happening was that they were regarding this as very important personally to them, this handshaking. And the concept of Sahala, I'm sure, was involved in that. Well, the Batak people heard stories about how Jesus said, let the little children come to me, and the disciples were trying to keep the children away, and he let them come, for of such are the kingdom of heaven. And in their understanding, this was saying that children of the kingdom of heaven have a special kind of sahala. The attitude towards children among the Batak people went through in a complete revolution. And where in the past orphans were, you know, just really had to scrape to get by, and many of them died, now it was considered a blessing to invite orphans into your home. Not in the way that we would do it, perhaps, as a part of our Christian duty. We would take some clothing down to the orphanage, or we might even concede to have them come to our house. But it was a blessing on us, for of such are the kingdom of heaven. And then we discover within the children the nature of God. Now, that's the kind of discovery thing. I'm sure that no Western missionary ever could have analyzed the culture thoroughly enough to figure that out and start manipulating the cultural symbols and say, what we really need to do is to preach this story in such a way that they're going to set up orphanages and so on and so forth. It's a case where the outsider discovers the working of the Spirit within the community. It's still happening at the level of these cultural meanings and values.
And then, keeping with your definition of faith, would one way in finding where the Spirit moves is to look for relationships, different types of relationships.
Now, a lot of traditional proclamation, we think of traditional proclamation, occurs as well. but the proclamation in the form of not saying this is the way things are, but this is a story. Let me tell you this story. And then this, the story itself is evocative of new meanings. It provides new opportunities for seeing how the what the faith means in this context and where it goes and where it grows.
Would you speak louder, please?
I'm sorry. When you think of Matthew 28, go therefore and make disciples of all people. You see that as a process kind of like getting on a conveyor belt, or maybe that's not a good way of putting it, but jumping down a stream, and you're riding down a stream, and you're doing a sort of a passage or a pilgrimage or whatever, rather than a goal or a purpose that you set before yourself. Our job is to go out and translate the Bible into every culture so that everyone can get acquainted with the earth, so that everyone can know the message about Jesus Christ and be baptized and saved. Am I clear there?
No. I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure where what you said.
Well, see, I
struggle with that a bit.
Okay, yeah. As I listen to Matthew 28, I hear a command. Well, I'll just say for purpose of argument, I hear a command. And that is that we have a purpose, you know, a mission, a goal, that we're to arrive at, and that is make the message available to everyone. But this other approach to mission that I'm hearing now, maybe for the first time in a clearer way, says that, well, maybe it's not important to aggressively go out there and make this available to everyone. Maybe it's important to go out there and see what God's doing.
Okay. I see what you're saying. I think the Great Commission very seriously. I think that what happens is that in our very word-oriented culture, we tend to think of make disciples of all nations, teaching them all that I have commanded you. We think of that in terms of literal content. Okay, we're going to teach you the creeds. Whereas I think we can take the commission just as seriously as a mandate. Making disciples of all nations is to open up the vision of the gospel in such a way that men will and women will respond to it and form the community, which is the discipleship of Christ. It's really a challenge to us. It is not teaching somebody to talk in a language they don't know. It is only teaching when the teaching is done in the language that is understood, and not necessarily the language of words, such as English and Chinese and Hindu and so on, but the language of the mind, the language of the level of meanings of culture that makes sense out of the world. And so our mandate to preach, to teach, to make disciples is also a mandate to understand and be ready to discover what the gospel is in another language, in another conceptual language, in another entirely different meaning framework. And in doing so, I mean, that means that missionaries, quote unquote, who also are missionaries in our own country, in our own local congregations, we all are missionaries. I start with that concept, that we're all missionaries in our own context. Here at Oldham Village, that a great deal of what it means to teach and preach and make disciples of all nations is to then discover the breadth of our faith and the breadth of the activity of Christ, which is way beyond what we in our own backyards can conceive of. And we come back then and have much to teach our own people.
You know, Dr. Warren, who is the president of Whitworth College, I'm from Presbyterian background, spoke about this many years ago to some of his students, how he went to Japan. He was talking to a man who later became a great Christian missionary in Japan, but he was trying to explain the Holy Spirit to him. And in their conversation, finally he said, Oh, I know who you're talking about. I just didn't know his name. And to me, this has opened up a whole new way of looking at the mission, how to interpret and how to understand and hope.
Very much akin to Paul preaching to the Athenians, saying, this unknown God that you have here, this temple to the unknown God, you want to cover all your bases. Well, this is the God I declare unto you, and this is what he's like. So I think that's somewhat akin. Yes?
I think that's very true as you get to read and understand the Native American spirituality, is to discover that it really is the same God, the same spirit working among us. It's just the culture has shaped the language that's used, but you know, if you get down to the spiritual level, there is no difference. You know, God is God, and the earth, we can learn so much from each other when we get to that point, instead of seeing it as their culture and our culture. When you can get beyond the superficial things and discover the activity of the spirit.
The world is falling apart.
Francis Bauer, Franciscan, admits, he said, I'm not going to go back to the Greek of the command, but he says, I don't see it as a command that carries a military connotation of very strict, this is what you're going to do, destroy, or, you know, it's very, he takes more of an invitation. Come on, let's make disciples, let's, and where you give an invitation is to a party where people can come and be themselves.